My name is Eben, and I'll be chairing this session here. And the panelists are Penelope Goat from the University of Manchester, where she works as a doctor. And you have been doing some work about early notations or conceptions about what kind of physical effect music had on the human body. Isn't that right? And second, we have Professor Helmi Järveloma from the University of Eastern Finland. And you have been doing some studies on the historical sound of the glass site. You know, the one where the house uses oat. Yeah, two. And first, Sten Kåre Nielsen works as an associate professor here at the University of Aarhus. Can you tell us something about what happened in 1889 when Gottfried Rubin demonstrated the imported phonograph from the Danish press? So you can hear that there's three very different approaches to this subject about historical sound objects. But I guess what you may have in common is the methodological challenges in studying historical sound objects, whether they are musical or not. And how do these objects manifest themselves, and are they objects, or are they more abstract discourses of phenomena, and how do we address these objects in the cultural and social practice? But we look forward to hear more about that. And the timetable will be so that you have 10 minutes each for a presentation, and then shortly take some comments from the panel just after the presentation. And then the last 20 minutes or so will be open for discussion with the audience. Okay. One of my research interests is early modern medical explanations for music's effects on people, a topic which seems to have been quite specialised in 18th century Britain, for example, since I have found only a handful of texts on the subject. The three sources I propose to address today are Richard Brown's Medicina Musica, or A Mechanical Essay on the Effects of Singing, Music and Dancing on Human Bodies, published in London in 1729. The second, Nicholas Robinson's A New System of the Spleen, Vapors and Hypochondriac Melancholy, also published in 1729. And thirdly, Richard Brocklesbury's Reflections on Ancient and Modern Music with the Application to the Cure of Diseases, published in 1749. Brown seems to have been a country apothecary, while Robinson and Brocklesbury, 20 years later, were London-based physicians. What I propose to do in this brief presentation is first to summarise the understanding that these medical men shared about the nature of music and its psychological and physiological effects. We will see that underpinning their medical explanations was the fundamental and widely held assumption that music moves the passions and is therefore implicated in good or bad behaviour, the realm of morals and ethics. Then I will go on to identify more specifically what each author has to say about music's role in maintaining health and curing disease, before playing you an example of some actual music that Brocklesby had in mind when talking about what he calls good music, which is to say the kind that properly expresses the passions, for example, joy or melancholy. The basic presumption of all three of my authors is that musical sound can have strong effects on people because it causes motion in the animal spirits which flow through the nerves and form the essential link between the material body and the immaterial soul or mind. As Robinson explains, these spirits are secreted from the most subtle parts of the blood and are responsible for sense, perception, and all bodily motion. Health is when there is a proper balance maintained between the body and soul, but the state of the mind can be adversely affected by the state of the body and vice versa. Thus, the passions of the mind, such as fear, anger, and hope, affect the body, for example, enhancing the symptoms of acute and chronic diseases, while the body's distemper causes the irregular flow of spirits and therefore therefore leads to mental disorders. Although none of these texts say so explicitly, the passions, what we now call the emotions, were understood as lying midway between the reason and the senses, their effects being due to the movement of the spirits. This basic assumption actually went back to antiquity, but the most specific source for 18th century thinking was Descartes' Les Passions de l'âme, published in 1649. Thus, music, through its movement, has a direct effect on the passions and can be used to regulate them. According to Robinson, sounds move the intellectual faculties first, and all three authors agree that harmony or melody can either raise or depress passions. There is, however, some difference in the extent to which they discuss how music can or should be used in this way. Robinson, for example, suggests it might be appropriate to try the force of sound on hypochondriac melancholy and other diseases of the mind, but he gives no evidence for actually having tried this. Brown, by contrast, seems to have thought through the issue in more detail. Thus, he argues that the best sounds for health are those created, quote, by a well-played consort of violins, especially in the context of Italian opera. He suggests that on the one hand, quote, the soft, languishing trills and melodious strains of an adagio played by a fiddle touch the nerves finely and produce a pleasing, ravishing sensation that evidently causes the spirits to flow back and forth in gentle undulations. On the other hand, if the strings of a fiddle are struck swiftly while playing a brisk and sprightly allegro, the listener will surely feel fresh life and vigour flow, quote, from the persuasive sound of such a sprightly, harmonious consort. With these two different effects on the nerves in mind, Brown goes on to suggest how they might be applied to prevent disease and preserve health. He says that an adagio is a good remedy against anger and rage, but can actually lead to disease if the spirits are not disordered to begin with, the solution in this case instance being to follow it with an allegro. Meanwhile, to cure a mental disease like melancholy, a sprightly allegro is good, and is also good for bodily ailments such as apoplexies and lethargies. But for madness, only what he calls a soft, languishing adagio will suffice. However, there is no suggestion that Brown himself has tried to administer any kind of musical medicine to test these suppositions. Brocklesby goes one step further than Brown by describing an actual case study of a deeply melancholic and grief-stricken Scottish gentleman who was eventually cured through listening to the harp, which was the patient's favourite instrument. Unfortunately, he doesn't identify exactly what kinds of music were played to effect this striking transformation. Brocklesby also considers music in the context of bodily disorders that affect the mind, such as delirium, melancholy, frenzy, and mania. For example, he suggests that music might be used in the cure of madness through capturing the mind's attention, making it easier to administer more conventional medicines as the patient is not so distracted in behaviour. For us today, the most interesting part of Brocklesby's essay is where he gives an example of music that we can actually hear for ourselves, albeit in a contemporary context. This information arises at the point where Brocklesby poses the stark question of why ancient music apparently had more power to raise the passions than modern music, a topic that had been in vogue since the 16th century. Brocklesby suggests that the main problems with many modern compositions is that they disregard the laws of the rhythmus or variation of time, which makes the words too difficult to understand. And also, the present-day musicians, quote, insist too much upon reiterated quavers on the same notes and introduce too many slurs into the composition. At this point, he introduces two modern examples that avoid these essentially rhythmic problems. These prove to be Handel's setting of Milton's L'Allegro, Il Penseroso ed Immoderato, and also his setting of Acis and Galatea, works that of all Handel's music keep, quote, truest to the rhythmus and therefore afford more delight in general than anything else of the kind. The first of these works was premiered on the 27th of February 1740 at the Royal Theatre of Lincoln's Inn Fields, While Acis, composed during 1718 and 19, was performed regularly in London up through 1741. In other words, Brocklesby was calling to mind music that he had probably heard about 10 years before he actually published Reflections on Ancient and Modern Music in 1749. We can therefore assume that it had made a vivid impression on him, unless he was only repeating the opinion of others, but I don't know who these might have been. Although we are given two examples of good music, I have chosen to focus on L'Allegro. The crucial feature of this work is that it has two main protagonists, each being the personification of a mood, the joyful man and the contemplative or melancholic man. The recitative and air I'm going to play are actually both sung by L'Allegro, performed by the tenor Ian Bostridge. But in the first movement, he is addressing melancholy and therefore expresses this passion both through the dialogue and the music to accompany it. It's mainly in minor keys with lots of leaps of a seven. By contrast, the second verse L'Allegro sings here expresses joy, which again is reflected in the words and music. And I'd like to just play you the two examples and then just finish by posing a couple of questions.
Thank you.
that music moved the animal spirits. Did 18th century listeners perceive and respond to music differently from us today, since we no longer recognise the existence of spirits? Whatever the answer, there is no doubt that these offered appropriately medicalised terms of discourse for talking about music's effects on inner states. Another question might be, how should we listen to this music in the light of Brocklesby's comments? Did Brocklesby think that a melancholic song actually evokes melancholy in the listener, or joy by the same token? Or is the listener's delight due more to an appreciation of the song's expression? He doesn't really say, and there's a confusion here between arousing and expressing passions that I think is never really disentangled in the 18th century. Thank you.
My experience of a historical sound object, but not that Penelope was doing that, but the experiences of historical sound objects by contemporary listeners in very early phonographic culture. Hence my title, Meeting an Eccentric Being, the Anthropomorphization, the Anthropomorphization of Edison's Improved Phonograph in Early Danish Press Reports. On Thursday, October 3rd, 1889, at 1 p.m., invited members of the Copenhagen Press gathered in the private flat of Consul General Gottfried Rubin to attend a demonstration of Edison's newly imported improved phonograph. 5 days earlier, as befits the monarchy, the very first demonstration had taken place at Frederiksborg Palace for the extended royal family, including the Tsar of Russia. But trying to turn this import into a successful business enterprise, what better way to begin generating popular interest and demand than by turning directly to the press and let it spread the hopefully good news? This is the printed program of the so-called phonographic seance. As could be expected, the press coverage was quite extensive, and already the evening edition of two major newspapers, Nationaltidende or Berlingske Tidende, carried reports. These were followed the next day by even more copious articles in Politiken or and Dagens Nyheder. So what did the journalists make of their encounter with the latest invention in an era of inventions, positioned as they were primarily as listeners? How did they describe their phonographic experience to their readers? I want to touch on just one to me, as a contemporary reader, these reports' rather fascinating theme, the recurring anthropomorphization of the phonograph as a sound reproducing performer, hence my title quoting one of the journalists. This view of the apparatus as a human performer was, considering the items of the program, obviously advocated by the phonographic agents themselves. The first recording reproduced was a greeting in Danish from the phonograph itself, so to speak, to the audience present. Part of it sounded, "I'm delighted on this occasion to present myself to the honorable members of the Copenhagen Press. I hope you will like me and contribute to my promotion." And later, this illusion was conjured up again when the phonograph described itself, this time in English, and demonstrated its extensive mastering of human sound by crying, whining, laughing, coughing, sneezing, whistling, and singing. Although all journalists were aware of the specific technological aspects involved in the mechanical recording and reproduction of sound, and duly reported these in separate paragraphs, the rendering of their actual experiences of hearing sound being reproduced was not primarily filtered through this technical discourse. The Politiken reporter even adopted the human performer angle wholesale and named his report Hos Phonographen, which in English translates as both at the phonograph and at the phonographer. But he is clearly not referring to Gottfried Rubin. According to this reporter, and I paraphrase, the phonograph was giving its first performance, although this eccentric being, as could be expected, did not stick strictly to the announced programme. Also, it was obvious that solo performances suited Monsieur the phonograph best, as when it blew the cornet, etc., etc. This report is tinged with a sense of humour throughout, and the anthropomorphization is obviously conscious and pursued slightly tongue-in-cheekish. But similar observations are also present in other press reports, as when the journalist von Dames Nyheder states that the phonograph knew how to differentiate between the three instruments in a trio recording. A statement that, technically speaking, is quite absurd, but resonates well with one of the often expressed mysteries at the time, especially as demonstrations of the phonograph spread to every man in town squares and marketplaces. How could one machine possibly handle the reproduction of several instruments at once? This question of interaction between the performer recorded and the performer reproducing the recorded performer was also highlighted in the reproduction of the song recording by well-known court singer Niels Juel Simonsen. Sadly, none of the cylinders used at the demonstration have survived, but the Rubin collection contains other recordings by Simonsen 5 years on. So before touching on the response to his singing, I want to give you an idea of what he sounded like, mediated by Edison's improved phonograph and several other phonographic devices, I may add. Here he is performing a still popular Danish song. Does not flatter Simonsen's singing. Quite the contrary, and I quote, It emphasized mercilessly, but rather curiously, the fine singer's flaws. End of quote. This casting of the phonograph as an almost consciously evaluating mediator is, of course, different from the notion of inaudible and therefore non-existent mediation that is still often associated with phonographic technologies. However, this latter notion is also present in the press reports and ties in well with a rather prevalent focus on the reproduction of sonic details. Thus, another reporter from Dagens Nyheder describes the phonographic reproduction of Simonsen's voice as being so exact that confronted with this recording, the singer would be startled by his own flaws. Compared to the first generation phonograph, which was also included in the seance to prove a leap in sound fidelity, all journalists seem to agree that the most startling achievement of the new improved phonograph was the fact that it was now possible to actually recognize the owners of the voices caught in wax. Thus, reproduced sound was constituted as personal representation. Was this realization somehow rubbing off on the perception of the machine? Was the wording a perhaps unwitting reflection of incomprehensibility as to how something as personal as the sound of specific human voices could possibly be contained and reproduced by purely mechanical means? Or was the more or less pronounced humanization of the phonograph simply an expression of the adaptation of a promotional strategy cleverly devised by Edison, Rubin and company to facilitate a fascination among potential customers with this new phenomenon of man-sounding machine? Teachers being taught as part of the strategic management of the social process of generating suitable phonographic literacy, as Jonathan Stern might have put it. Either way, and other interpretations can certainly be added, these press reports raise fascinating questions about the social cultural appropriations of and interactions with the phonograph in the coming to terms with the notion of canned human sound. Thank you.
Something or the fate shared by many other fashionable scholarly concepts. Over recent decades, it has become to mean almost anything in the past with which we have some kind of an emotional bond. However, the profound explorations of the concepts by Karin Johannesson and Svetlana Boym help us to use the concept as an analytical tool. They both consider nostalgia to be a creative and reflective emotion which organizes the subject's time and space for the future. In this short position paper, I'm dealing with the changing soundscape aesthetics and ambiences of agriculture in Bissingen, southern Germany, focusing especially on one particular historical sound mentioned in an interview, that of the farmer Hans Edele, living in Bissingen. The concept of nostalgia is not the exclusive property of researchers. It belongs to the vocabulary or the interviewers as well. What can we say about sonic remembering in this particular case? When the farmer himself occasionally describes his own thinking as nostalgic, how are we to interpret his notion? Is it useful to analyze his nostalgia in terms of Svetlana Boym's restorative reflective nostalgia. Let me go straight to the discussion of the memories of the vanished sounds in Missingen, the interview with the farmer Edele and his notions of nostalgia, pleasure and time. So, as we can see, here we are, here is the farmer. I'm interviewing him with a colleague from Germany, cultural researcher, in fact, folklorist, Ute Wächter. Here is, so A, I think A is the farmer, B is myself, and C is Ute. So we can see that we are talking about the sonic past. Edele changes quite fluently between German and English languages because he has been a student, exchange student in the US as a young man. And also the interviewer is somehow managing both languages. Here I'm asking Hans Edele to go deeper into the subject of vanished voice, vanished sounds. We have been discussing this earlier, but here I ask in German, and could you please mention sounds, other sounds that that one cannot hear anymore in Missingen? You and the farmer is answering. You mean these sounds that we have been describing? Yes, yes. Or the one when somebody is mowing grass with a scythe. Hans Edele is here introducing a new vanished sound, mowing grass with a scythe. Edele does not speak of mowing in the morning in the wet grass solely as his personal memory. He is remembering, or rather, together we construct the remembering. The matter is recounted in passive mode. Both in German and English language, the farmer is using the expression when somebody is, which I hear as a detachment from the personal discourse. So we go on. So he says, in the morning, in the early morning, oh yes, and the grass has been wet, it makes a different noise by morning than a few hours later. Very different. After the opening, Edele elaborates on the special quality of the sound one hears when using the sight in the early morning. It might be significant that he speaks in the present tense. It makes a different noise in grass that is wet from the early morning dew as compared with later in the day. The fact that noise is very different in the wet grass has not vanished, even if the sound itself has become practically non-existent. The sound of it in the morning, in the wet grass, is still present in memory, and this is emphasized by the use of the present tense, which somehow makes the sound more immediate and real. In any event, the way Edele differentiates the various sounds of the sight gives me, the listener, or the talk, a sense of the vividness of his lived and remembered experience. And here we have Ute asking in German, it's not possible to hear any of these two sounds anymore. Her sound is very empathetic, dropping in pitch, both sounds. And the farmer continues, no, it's me, I'm asking. And was it nice when it was wet? The German, I found it very interesting when I listened to the tape and heard Ute's voice. She marked the topic as emotional with her own empathetic voice. Her contribution to the discussion is more like a summary than a question, conveying in both words and tone her regret that it is not possible to hear the sight. Her personal regret is also compounded with empathy for the interviewee's sense of the loss. To a great extent, it would be entirely natural for us, Ute and myself, the strangers, to feel nostalgia for vanished sound. It has often been observed that it is, quote, the romantic traveler who sees from distance the wholeness of the vanished world, end quote. This is from Svetlana Boyle. It is the journey and the perspective of the outsider that generates the native idyll. as the second interviewer, I push on. I'm somehow seeking a clearer statement about the nature of Hans Oederle's aesthetic experience. I'm trying, first in German, then in English, whether it was nice to move and listen to the sound in the early morning view. So I'm asking whether he liked the sound. Did you like that sound? Because you said, but he's interrupting me right in the sentence, well, it's a kind of nostalgia, he says in German. Oh yes, I understand. Today I have to get done several things, so very soon everything has to go faster. Oh yes, and so I can't do it like this. He has a huge tractor in which he drives his wheels and he's closed in the cabin and cannot hear anything but his radio. So we hear a shift in his perspective so that he is now observing his own remembering from outside. He's able to categorize something that a moment ago he was describing in very delicate aesthetic terms as a in a very delicate aesthetic terms, and now he's just kind of saying, no, well, it's a kind of nostalgia. He is certainly not anymore within the hearing point memory. I'm borrowing from Freud. He has something like viewpoint memory, when you are kind of inside the feeling you are remembering. But he's now outside. He's in the position of hearing and looking his own practice from outside as an observer. As Svetlana Boym has noted, nostalgia is still often a taboo, since it seems like a waste of time and an unaffordable luxury. It inevitably reappears, it inevitably reappears as a defense mechanism in a time of accelerated rhythms of life and historical upheavals. This is what Boym. And the more nostalgia there is, the more hotly it is denied. And again, I understand that it's only nostalgia for him, and I still try to, yes, but do you sometimes do it just for the pleasure, because you remember, and again he's interrupting me, I don't have time for pleasure, and then we laugh. So I'm again laughing, really? And he's, no, okay. But you can very clearly remember the sound, at least. It's sure. The meaning of the activity of mowing is well understood by Oederle, and in this case it is constructed as no longer having much importance. To my question whether he liked the sound, he answered that the sound or remembrance of the sound is nostalgia. Oederle is moving here very interestingly and instructively between the short moment of, quote, abdication of personal responsibility. This again, Boym talks about this, of immersing himself in the unforgettable sound of the site early in the morning view in the past and returning to the present, from which position the idea of actually trying to replicate the past by mowing my hand would represent folly, though he recognizes this with good humor. It is indeed, as Boym says, that the nostalgia taboo makes people to feel that, quote, looking back might paralyze you forever, turning you into a pillar of salt like Lord's wife. Even though the interviewers might have seemed inclined to relinquish critical thinking for emotional bonding, as often happens when nostalgia is involved, the farmer himself, Hans Oederle, does not significantly relinquish critical rationalism to any extent. The sound or the sight has been incorporated and can be remembered as present past, which can be said to be Oederle's state of experience. He is making a living out of farming and expects to continue to do so. This horizontal expectation precludes the possibility of reverting to a site, even if only briefly, for pleasure. He is a rational, modern farmer, and as such, does not have time to indulge in such pleasure. Adela refers to the fact that it is economically impossible to return to the time when sighs were hissing in the wet grass in the mornings. He fully appreciates the fact that today's workload makes it impossible for the sound or sight to exist as anything but a cherished memory. But this does not mean that the sonic memory has no meaning for him. As one side of his identity, it fortifies his sense of who he is in the world. In today's world, where most of us people suffer from time poverty, we can only dream of different chronotopes and time spaces. Thank you.
I was thinking that I think it has been studied by technology scholars that when computers came, for example, they were often, and I think still are, anything new that comes, you struggle with the digitized TV that we have in Finland now, you tend to personalize it when you talk to the machine.
I think it's a very, very common way to appropriate your surroundings and new objects, so to speak. And it's everywhere, really. And in that sense, it may not have been all that unusual in this sense, but it would be quite interesting to find parallels in newer technology.
I mean, something that just springs to mind is that you referred to it as a seance, which was a term actually used in the press, was it?
Yes.
And I wondered if there was any allusion to the English meaning of seance, which is only means a spiritual one. And of course, that's disembodied voices or, you know, a lack of body.
That's a very good question, actually. It was used in the press because it was used in the programme. And Morgan, at least, used it, talked about chronographic seances. And of course, I definitely have to look into this because the question of spiritism, I don't know if it was still, whether it was greater, but whether it really happened in the 1880s. But But then again, I'm not quite sure they were actually trying as part of the anthropomorphization to actually guide, you know, the listeners into this sense of something slightly mystical. Or, of course, as Jonathan Stern has talked about, Ergonopoly has this tomb of the dead, keeping the dead alive and all this. Of course, that could be another add-on here, because, of course, spirited is about getting into contact with the voices that are on the world.
Yes, continuing your line of thought there. Arbitrary, I checked with the Encyclopaedia Britannica, the 1911 edition, where the word medium only is used to describe spiritism media. There's nothing about medium being photography, photography, or whatever, even though you have those words as well in the Encyclopaedia. And I think that actually relates back to the seance question. That there's a tiny difference between what we know as medium and the spirits and so on. And perhaps that is relating back to the Metalbert's paper as well, that the spirits, passions and so on. I mean, perhaps our iPods are the spirits of today.
Possibly. Can I just, the word medium does not, it's not used in the press reports at all. But of course, if it was, that would be highly interesting, very interesting. But that's a good point, you know.
I mean, there is a good, there's a very good book called Instruments and the Imagination by Hankins and Silverman in 1995. And they look at a series of technologies of sound and voice and vision, the camera obscura and so on, from the 17th century through to the 19th. And it's always talking about the slippage between instruments for devices for entertainment and display, for mystery and for demonstration, and then for research. In fact, a lot of instruments that start out as games or entertainment become more serious later. And I'll just quickly give you a good example is that Isaac Newton developed his theory of the rainbow and his theory of light based on a toy prism that he bought at Stourbridge Fair. So, you know, just to
yes, and all of the microphone doesn't work, so we have to maybe stand
okay,
up.
Okay, that's what Penny does.
Stand up, Ola.
Sorry. Wow. How close I got. we have some early kind of soundscape research where Monteverdi is sneaking around listening to people having roars when doing research is the compartiment with time to the Clorinda, finding out that these different quavers to many actually signifies anger and desperation and so forth and so on. We have an old affect in there development. People have been learning this, and through the Counter-Reformation and so forth, they got it from church, whether they wanted to or not. So, after about a little more than a century of schooling into developing the sensibility for that these kinds of things go together with these kinds of feelings, and the development of these gestures also sometimes being based on actually soundscape research, listening on how people actually sound in everyday situations. It's kind of interesting to find out that they developed some kind of scientific medical explanation of the fact that had been a part of the media.
Yeah, there's a definite correlation between, on the one hand, the actual practices of musicians give rise eventually to scientific theory. I mean, I'm absolutely convinced it's art leads to science.
Yeah. So that's one part with it, that it actually, it's not a new finding, it's confirmation that what you've tried for so long, actually, that the media propaganda has turned into kind of naturalized effectiveness, and what we, the stereotypes we learn from the media are experienced as natural, as coming from the natural sciences and being explained by natural means. And I think we can learn something from that today as well. Mm-hmm. The other part is the intonation. In the discussions at that time, the temperature system, what kind of intonation you use actually was very crucial in most of the discourses, whether some interest should sound heavenly, some should sound really ugly. And this kind of was central part of it. And on this representation, we can hear that. We heard a rather modern voice post 1820s, I think, and the voice quality, rather modern instruments that were playing very good. So we didn't really get that aspect, which was thought to be very central at the time. So we discussed this, sort of, this is an old discussion. I just had to make comments, sorry.
Stephen Schwartz, I have a question for all of you, and especially you. As someone who is very interested in collecting archives of exactly the sound of a sigh in the wet grass or the dry grass or some other kind of grass, or the sound of some other farm implements, or all of the sounds of our audio culture, I have to say that there is no sound archives like that in Denmark. And if I'm wrong about this, I'd love to be made wrong. Nobody is collecting these sounds and putting them into an archive. There does exist a sound archive in the Danish radio, and you can buy CDs with sounds from Denmark for about 14,000 krona, as long as they last. And nobody is making these archives anymore. Now, there's an archives for spoken famous people speaking. Yes, there it is. There's archives for just about any kind of music you can imagine whatsoever. Nothing about what we call real sound, or however you term this. I want to know how many people here have an archives in their countries of what I would call sound effects, or I don't know what term you use. You know what I'm talking about.
Somebody sitting on it, no one can use it, anyone else but the journalists, of course. But, I think, I mean, somebody was, Jean-Paul Thibault was talking about that we don't have recordings or smell, or how the documents, or how it smells from different times of the past. But, it's certainly true what you say about the sound. We don't come to think about it, and we don't have.
I wonder. I'm sure in the radio demo is in the archives. There must be libraries of sound effects. Of course, they may have been bought from somewhere. You know, used in radio drama and so on. Or I don't know if any of them could have been produced by themselves.
I work for the Danish radio. I make lots of sounds for our archives. Nobody can get into them. It's not public domain.
No, okay.
That's my point.
Oh, sorry.
How are we going to deal with audio culture without providing audio culture for people who want to study it, who want to listen to it, who want to use it? Please, people.
Yes, that's a good point.
We have three comments, questions more, so I think we have to close after that.
Thank you. Even mentioned at the beginning of the session that methodology might be of interest here. And I'm thinking also in relation to the question of archive. I see a danger in the nostalgic dimension that I hear as a subtone in all three papers. There's something lost here. We have lost something. And I was wondering also, I mean, when Sten presented the sound, it was more of a static hiss than anything else. We have no, we cannot hear that sound anymore whatsoever, no matter how much we dig into the archives. And I'm sort of wondering, how do we critically engage with this material as historical objects without getting lost in the loss?
Can I just I strongly disagree with the fact that there is nostalgic undertone. At least I talked about nostalgia. I was trying to analyze how people talk about nostalgia without. Of course, it's difficult to be so self-referential, but I don't confess. But you're absolutely right. That's something I forgot to say, that of course the sonic excerpts, the sounds in archive, they are usually totally uncontextualized. They are very hard to, I mean, it's very, very hard to say what can we do with ourselves. That's true.
And that was what I was talking about yesterday, exactly, because if you perceived an undercurrent of nostalgia, it was at least intentional. Because what I was talking about yesterday was the whole notion of what we are listening for now when we have engaged with these so-called historical sound objects. And I think you can adopt various strategies, of course, and I don't think you can rule them out completely as sources of information. I don't think you can. But you have to be very, very conscious of what you listen for. How you constitute these objects when you engage with them. And as I said, that was what I was talking about yesterday. They are tricky sources of research.
Thank you.
Just a question, a point about the archive thing, because I'm sure you probably know about the British Libraries thing there. Just the thing about that, I suppose, is that in the sacrifice of quality for speed and flexibility, I suppose what you actually get is that there is a sort of banal and quotidian sound things. Like the fact, because of that, I now know what a guy four doors down the road sounds like making toast and things. But I think kind of because of that kind of flexibility, I think that's kind of just starting to happen. I just thought you probably already knew about that project, but it seems like those projects where the tools are not left to the specialists, perhaps, is much more of that archiving that's going on in a potentially more interesting way.
I don't think as a dean I can get into your archive.
It's you can, it's just online, it's completely publicly available. Yeah. It's in the British Library website, it's the UK Soundscape Project or Soundmap.
Sorry, I'm sure there would be some limitations if a dane tried to approach that sound online. I'm quite sure the British Library collections are not just open to access from abroad, I'm sure.
You
may have to register as a, I don't know, but it's, I don't think it's that simple.
Yeah, because it's just like a Google map with a click in it, and a gallery there.
Everything is available. I know that from personal experience. Even from records which we digitize are not available, and avoid them.
Thank you. Leslie Corrick from York University in Toronto. Just a few observations on the three really interesting historical sound objects. Returning to the phonograph again, I know suggestions have already been made about how you might further contextualize the anthropomorphization of the phonograph. Another way you might consider doing that is to look back in time towards the early history of automata, starting in the early modern period, 15th, 16th century. But even if you begin with the Enlightenment, there's a whole history of the, what should we say, the mechanica or the machina associated with inanimate forms that become animate, the defecating duck, the flute player, and so on. And I think that sort of trajectory, very much situated in Western Europe, might also be behind this phenomenon of your improved phonograph. So just a suggestion in that regard. And I also wanted to comment on your comment about intonation with regard to the 17th and 18th century texts that were presented. It seems to me that you're right on a certain level, that one might, in the best of all possible worlds, want to recapture that intonation. But as far as the construction of the passions, musical passions are concerned with respect to health and medicine, I think, and Penelope, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it has as much to do with, or even more to do with, the modes, the melodic structure, as it has to do with the intonation that comes out of singing. The tradition of the passions really resides in those, the ethos or the ethical aspects of the modes that precede the major and minor scales. So I think even if we listen to a modern recording and we can't get the intonation, we can still get some sense of the melodic structure that perhaps created these healthy effects or unhealthy effects through music. And I guess I wanted to make one comment about also about the availability of these sound bits from daily life. There seems to be a lot of debate about what's successful and what's not, but there is at least one site that's being generated out of the Smart Lab, which is the Lab for Music and Auditory Research at Ryerson University in Toronto, which is free access, and I think it's www.torontosoundmap.com.
Thank you.